You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vohner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Lately, I shouldn't say lately, I think it's been pretty much ongoing, is the fact that everybody has been getting a dose of climate change and across the globe, between heavy snows out in California, floods and extreme weather in the Midwest and down south, in fact, earthquakes, you name it, it's been hitting this this planet pretty hard, and I think it's really gotten a lot of people's attention. Not that it hasn't in the past, but I think there's been more emphasis in the last few years. But the question is, are people aware? Are people doing something about it? Are people on board with this? And I'm sure you can talk to your neighbors, you can talk to family, friends, and you'll find out that not everybody takes it serious, and other people are really over the top. And that's why I've invited my guest this week, activist and author Andrew Boyd. And we'll be talking with Andrew for the next half hour about his new book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. And I think he, apropos, Andrew, the title really sums it all up. Grief, hope, and humor. Depending on who you're talking to, some people are fearful that this this climate change is the Armageddon of the globe. It's going to take us all down. Other people shrug it off as, hey, you know, this earth has been around for millions and billions of years. It'll be here forever. But you're an activist by nature. You've studied this stuff closely. Is anything that we've heard from the science community, anything we've heard from the government, is any of that sound like a long shot? Or are they right on with their calculations?
Well, first, Al, it's a pleasure to be on the show. Thanks for having me. As you say, people are more and more aware of a kind of a global weirding, you know, climate chaos, like very strange, you know, the beginnings of the impacts of climate change. And there's people have a lot of different reactions, from denial to, you know, just assuming that we're doomed and therefore doing nothing, to you know, deep concern and people digging in and doing whatever they can in their communities at the national level, starting organizations, everything from, you know, recycling to passing a Green New Deal. So it's very, as you say, it's very much on people's minds, even if what their minds are doing are, you know, sort of pushing it away as hard as they can.
Have, in your experience, you talk to many more people about this particular issue, so you get the chance to face off with many people. Do you get the sense, because I don't, some people, you know, I've got a neighbor that's over the top and believes in all of this, but the rest just, this is the same thing they had back there in the Civil War. This is the same thing they had, you know, 200 years ago, and they just shrug it off, and I'm thinking, okay, so where should I be on this? I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, right. I'm sort of like between 2 and 4. Do I put more emphasis? Do I do more research? Do I prepare myself? What I'm asking is, are Americans by and large on board with this, and do they have the right expectations and the right focus to deal with this issue?
Yeah, I think there's an increasing awareness that it's a real problem. There's an array of solutions that not only address the problem of climate change, but make for, you know, cleaner water, cleaner air, healthier communities. So a lot of America, you know, we're a very pragmatic kind of people. We like to get her done. And I think when people are, instead of being presented with there's nothing to be done, there's just doom, it's too complicated, there's an overwhelm, that kind of an approach turns people off, and understandably so. It's scary, it's complicated, but when you approach people with, this is a crisis of existential significance, but there's it's also an opportunity to make a better world, to make a healthier community, then I think people respond. in a sort of positive way, in a engaged way, in a let's turn these lemons into let's turn these lemons into lemonade.
I know.
Please.
What caught my attention, and I'm not going to say that I've had my head in the sand. Sometimes I'm, more active, and then other times kind of sitting back and watching to see what happens, only because the debates have been, back and forth, and then it simmers for a while, and then it comes back. But most recently, I've never been to California, but if you had asked anybody, you want beautiful weather, you got to go out west to California. Northern California, just north of Sacramento, in the last 2 weeks, in fact, they're expecting more. Record snows. We're not talking about, 8 to 10 inches here like we expect in New England or even upstate New York. 6-7 feet of snow. Andrew, that caught my attention, and that makes me think, wow, there's a lot of truth to what people are talking about. Something's going on. But let me get back to the premise of all of this. Is this man-made? Is this problem man-made?
Yeah, for sure. 97% of scientists, agree with the basic theory of global warming that, putting carbon dioxide, methane, greenhouse gases into the air has over the last 30 years, but over the last 200 years, ever since the Industrial Revolution, has slowly and now much faster heated up the atmosphere. We are now 1.1 degrees centigrade, that's like 2.5 Fahrenheit, warmer than we were 200 years ago. And that is having a calamitous, we're just starting to see the calamitous impacts, rising sea levels, floods, Arctic ice is no longer freezing up. 50% melt of the Arctic, insect-borne diseases sort of moving from the tropics north, all sorts, coral bleaching, forest fires, not just the huge snows in California, but the forest fires, like really destabilizing the climate, 70-degree Fahrenheit temperatures in the Arctic. I mean, the list goes on. We've all heard it. We've all read it in bits and pieces. But where it comes back to is that the fossil fuel industry, greenhouse gas emissions heat the atmosphere and destabilizes the climate in all of these kind of global weirding kind of ways. And it is increasing. We're at 1.1. And scientists tell us if we pass 1.5 degrees centigrade of global warming, then things could, get into a cycle of deep instability, and that we may not be able to rein back in through a transition that we're in the process of from fossil fuels to renewables. So, yes, it's very real. The science is grounded. The entire scientific community is behind it. And Americans and people all over the world are coming to understand that truth and see its actual effects.
It's
and take action.
There's no question. I mean, like I said, I got a chill. I'm not talking about because of the weather. Just watching, people's homes being consumed by, covering windows out in that California region. And I'm thinking, man, this is real. This is really happening. But I want to get back to, how you've interpreted all of this through the book. But before doing so, I just want to take a quick pause and remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is activist and author Andrew Boyd. His new book is I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. And Andrew, I get it. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm thinking you took a step back and said, I'm a true believer in this. I don't want to panic people. So let me put forth my ideas. Let me put forth what the scientists are saying, but let me do it in a user-friendly way, but also in a way that doesn't, cause people to push the panic button, because as well as I do, basically most humans have two modes. You're neutral or you're in high gear. Obviously, we want something done about this. Obviously, we want people to take heed of all of this, as you were talking about. But we also don't want people to overreact, because sometimes mistakes are made and errors that may not be reversible. But it was that the basic premise of writing the book, is to kind of put forth the message without scaring the living daylights out of people.
I think, to use you're saying the concern is that people might overreact. I think we're in a situation where we have been underreacting for decades. Mm-hmm. And so we are in a situation which has put us in a situation of basically an emergency mode. So we actually do need to, I don't know if it's an overreaction, we do need to react at the level the problem deserves, at the scale and speed that the problem deserves. So it's basically a World War II level mobilization of our economy and society to transition it in a very fundamental way off of fossil fuels, off of oil and gas and coal, to be powered by renewables. Now, that is already underway. The world's energy, already 13% of it comes from renewables. It is already cheaper to install new solar and wind than to keep an existing coal plant running. So that transition is already underway. It just needs to be moving a lot faster, so that basically we get, as President Biden has said, we get more than 50% of our economy running on renewables by the end of the decade. I would argue that it has to be in a much higher number if we want to avoid those red lines that scientists have told us not to cross. But it's in process, but we need to sort of react even more strongly than we are. And that's every community, the federal government, every individual. There are many things that we can do at all of those levels, and we must do them harder and faster.
I guess where I get sort of bogged down and start mm-hmm. thinking, that sounds, that sounds doable. That makes common sense. But we're creatures of habit. And I'm talking about human that exists on this planet. You get up in the morning, that car is waiting in the garage or in the driveway. You got your computer, you got your cell phones, you got your TVs.
Your coffee.
Got your coffee. You put your rubbish out the same way you've been doing since, day one. So, it would require, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it would require people to alter their current behaviors and change. That would seem to me to be an impediment to all of this, because most people, as much as they say they're for global change, climate change, I should say, and that they're willing to do something, when it comes down to actually doing it, will they or can they make the changes necessary?
I'm a hopeful person. So, and I've seen a lot of evidence that people are making many of those changes. I mean, look at all the change that people have made in the past, right? And look at what happened when we decided something was, a national mission, an emergency. Look what we were able to do in World War II. People hitchhiked. And 4 days after Pearl Harbor was bombed, we didn't produce any personal automobiles, right? The entire economy was retooled for the war effort. We became the arsenal of democracy because we understood that it was, essential thing to do for ourselves, for our children, for our future, for democracy, for the good of the world. And we're in a similarly existential challenge before us. But just to note some of the small changes, people recycle. We didn't used to do that, 30, 40 years ago, and it feels like that's part of our new habits. People, people who have electric vehicles charge their cars, overnight. That sounds like almost, if you were to say that 20 years ago, that would sound kind of almost like something out of the Jetsons, right? But it's become, a new habit. So I think if many, we can learn new habits, especially when they are cleaner, when they are beginning to be cheaper, and when there is a sense of mission to them, that this is the good and right thing to do, and we're all starting to do it together, And I think habits can change very, very quickly.
Well, that's encouraging. I mean, you know, as I said, I'm a creature of habit, and sometimes it's, you know, you need a stick of dynamite to get me to change. You know, I'm still using landline at home, and, you know, it frustrates family and friends, and they think this guy ought to be in the Smithsonian. But
you're a radio guy. It makes sense that you got a landline at home. Okay?
It's like salvation.
You know, I'm an on-the-road activist. It makes sense I have a cell phone. You know, But your family should get used to that.
Serenity now, right? but coming back to the point, it is a serious issue. We're seeing it. I've admitted it. You know, 7-8 feet of snow in Northern California. I'm sorry. They have a drought issue, but they don't need all of that all at once. And in other parts of the world, we're seeing earthquakes. We're seeing landslides. We're seeing storms. When you talk about, you know, down the Midwest and down south, with tornadoes and hurricanes being more fierce than in past. So it's no question, Andrew. It's there. It's happening. But you don't want, correct me if I'm wrong, you don't want people to be in a panic mode. But as you said, you want them to move forward, make concerted efforts to make changes. So going back to my original premise, who becomes instrumental in all that? Is it government's role to take the lead and say, look, if you're not going to do things on your own, we're going to legislate, and you're going to have to abide by these rules, because in the long run, it's going to be good for everybody. So does government have a real stake in this, and do they have an obligation to legislate laws to get people to enact stricter climate initiatives so that we all have a safer planet?
Yeah, I think their action needs to happen at all levels, right? There are things we can do as individuals, like fly less, ideally eat less meat. That doesn't mean no meat at all, but eat less meat, mm-hmm. bicycle more, take public transport, try to, you know, if we can, if it's affordable for us, transition from our gas-guzzling vehicle to an electric vehicle. So there's things we can do at the individual level. There's things we can do at the community level. Make it easier to install solar, right? There's a lot of regulations around that. That's at the state and local level. Make it easier, subsidize the solar, make it easier to install solar and make money by selling it back to the grid. There's things we can do at the national level, and passing like what was called for a huge Green New Deal. And we got pieces of that in Biden's infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act that will make it easier for companies, easier for communities, easier for, startups and entrepreneurs to make that transition. So it's government has we have a role as individuals, make changes in our daily lives. Communities can move forward with this transition, and government can lay down a better rules of the road, both regulating the bad stuff and creating a glide path for the good stuff.
And that's a good point, because I think I'm thinking of business, and I'm not saying that hands off businesses, because if they're participating in this, especially large corporations, manufacturing facilities, whatever it may be, and again, I'm not pointing the finger at anybody, but if there are incentives, obviously we want to keep people employed. We want to keep the U.S. economy, even the global economy, going. So we don't want to see businesses, having to be forced because of new climate regulations to close down. But if they're given incentives, then they're more likely to make those changes. Again, going back to, because it's so interesting, how you deal with all of this in the book. You talk about climate activists, when they talk before groups of people, when they're interviewed, the need to grieve might be the best starting point. I don't know that it, and I don't know if you buy into that. I'm not grieving, but then again, you or I maybe haven't been hit over the head as hard as some people. I mean, if you're sitting in a house in California this morning, in Northern California, you've got 8 feet of snow and you can't get food, water, you have no access to, your electricity is out, no connections with the outside world. That is a, I'd be scared, I'd be grieving, I'd be pulling the hairs out of my head. So again, it goes back to the thing, the premise. Can you scare people? I mean, are activists trying to intentionally put the fear of God into people so that they'll get off their duff and do something?
I personally don't think that, you know, fear mongering is a, you know, or doomsplaining, you know, as the kids call it,
yeah,
is personally a, you know, very effective strategy. I think there's enough just in the news reports to scare the hell out of us if we're, you know, willing to pay attention to it. I don't think needing to double down there. I think showing just it's more the call to action that I think is important in terms of grieving. I think it's not so much, you know, being snowed in as much as, say, the, you know, the 1,000 people who in many cases unnecessarily drowned in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, or the hundreds in Hurricane Sandy, or the, you know, the whole towns that have been burned away in California, and, you know, just much far worse things across the globe. And, you know, Miami is slated to, you know, basically go under the water in, you know, 30, 50, you know, years.
Yeah.
And that's something we know that's going to happen, you know. Many other cities, Boston, a lot of that is landfill, right?
Right.
New York, some of that is landfill.
Right.
There are very, you know, our beloved cities, you know, 50% of Americans live 50 miles from the coast. You know, a lot of us are in the path of rising sea level. So it's not so much grieving the hard time getting, you know, opening your door with 7 feet of snow sort of piled against it as much as the deaths and destruction that have happened from the extreme weather events that have already happened and then the ones we know are coming. The UN says possibly a million species are in the path of extinction if we don't, you know, if we let things get worse. You know, that's like, there's a lot of grieving, you know, that we could, you know, our hearts imagine. This is one scenario, and so our hearts are imagining this possible world and what will happen to the things we love in it, never mind our children and our grandchildren and the next seven generations to come, and our beloved, you know, some of our beloved places on this planet. You know, the Australians are like, my grandkids are never going to enjoy the Great Barrier Reef, you know, because of the acid in the ocean, because of absorption of carbon from the atmosphere, bleaching the coral reefs and destroying that entire habitat. You know, you could go on. So there's a lot to grieve. The thing is, to not block it out. So, you know, you don't want to overwhelm yourself. You don't want to wreck yourself, but you want to live in the truth of our situation. And so and grief can be a block to, being honest, and it could be a block to taking any action.
Yeah.
So that's why it's important, so that we can go through it, so we can be more whole and grounded and sane and functional and engaged.
Yeah. Key word this. The key word sane. We need a little more sanity.
Right.
It's interesting because you're right. The North Shore of Massachusetts, the South Shore of Massachusetts, one of the most coveted regions. People flock there because of the spectacular view of the Atlantic Ocean. Many have put homes. In the last 4 or 5 years, when a storm has come, especially with storm surges, those expensive homes that people built right on the ocean that for years gave them, you know, pleasure and beauty. I've seen those things, the ocean take it right out, everything gone in a matter of minutes. So what you're talking about is absolutely real, and everybody needs to get on board with this. But in the final closing moments, you know, there's so much to the book, and that's really what, you know, hopefully people will go out and you know, read it from cover to cover and then draw their own conclusions. But with that said, I know you go out speaking before groups. You've been an activist for many, many years. At this point in your career, are you feeling more optimistic than pessimistic?
I don't think either of those really capture the situation we're in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the book, you know, was an investigation into the kind of hope that would serve us knowing what we know about the science, you know, what kind of hope would serve us. And it's not just a simple, like, optimism. Hey, I think, you know, I see some good news and I see some trend lines and I'm going to sort of clutch my lottery ticket and, you know, figure that everything's going to come out okay. And just, you know, it's more of a deep kind of a kind of hope where you're doing what's right because it's right. You know, a hope that is sort of independent of outcome, mm-hmm. right? It's a kind of hope that you believe something is worth doing, you know, protecting these beloved places, protecting the earth for the next generation, trying to transition from a, you know, world where we're basically poisoning ourselves to one where we are powering ourselves with the free and God-given sunlight and wind, you know?
Yes.
That is worth doing, regardless of how, you know, what the probabilities are of success or, you know, what kind of world we may be able to salvage, right?
Right.
So it's, you know, so it's all the good that we can do is worth doing. And so sort of my motivation, my hope kind of rests in that. And, you know, and I use the humor to help me along, you know, mm-hmm. to leaven it, to make it bearable. And, you know, we didn't really get to talk about that part, but that's a big part of the book.
Yeah.
And a reason for folks to check it out.
Exactly. Exactly.
And a way to hold the difficulty, yeah. Yeah, hold the challenge we face. Yeah.
You know, I wish we had more time so we could cover more of it. But, you know, sure. The important thing is that people go out and buy the book. I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. My guest has been the author and activist, Andrew Boyd. And Andrew, real quick, if people want to reach out to you directly, is there a website? Is there an email? Is there a way of just getting more information on your work?
Yeah. Thanks, Al. Yeah. BetterCatastrophe.com. BetterCatastrophe.com is information about the book. You can read excerpts without having to buy it. You can buy it from any number of sources there. And you can see where I am speaking, various, you know, speaking across the country.
Sounds so, good to me. Yeah, all the information, mm-hmm. as Andrew said, it's all right there. And you can research what he's been doing, where he's going to be, and where he'll be speaking. And again, most importantly, buying the book and reading it and hopefully taking it to heart. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.